History tells us where we've been, and it has a way of telling us where we're going. I'm Annette John Hall. Throughout February and beyond, we'll be bringing you Real Black History, a series of stories that looks at the fight for equality Black people have waged throughout history. In our first episode, we hear from a historian who tries to counter white reenactors' glorification of the Confederacy by debunking myths about it. Then, we'll turn to a Black man who performed for decades as a Civil War reenactor to bring awareness to the contribution of African Americans who served. The Civil War and its aftermath, the era known as Reconstruction, was intended to put Blacks on equal footing. But from this promising turning point for our nation emerged insidious Jim Crow laws, which stripped away most rights for newly freed Black citizens, including the right to vote. Scott Hancock teaches at Gettysburg College in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, the site of the famous Civil War battle, and where President Abraham Lincoln gave his famous Gettysburg Address. With monuments commemorating soldiers who fought on both sides, it's a popular location for Civil War reenactments. It's where Hancock and his friends engage Confederate reenactors once or twice a year to push for an accurate version of history.
Many of them have ancestors who were Confederate veterans, as do many of the Union reenactors.
But Hancock often sees something other than simple fascination with history in those reenactors. He sees a longing for a period that he and others see as not the best time for America, and shadows of white supremacy.
I don't know that they're the majority. I don't think they're probably the majority of Confederate reenactors, but I have no idea what percentage they'd be. Hopefully it's a tiny percent.
When Hancock sees these displays, which often include the Confederate flag and other symbols of an American South where slavery was widespread, he feels compelled to engage with them.
Part of my goal is, okay, so here's some information for you so you can kind of understand what the problems are with these kind of glorifications and sanctification of the Confederacy. To some extent, I am a bit trying to poke the bear, but I want to poke the bear so the bear will talk with me. So I try to point out things like Robert E. Lee, his wife owned 189 slaves, and he profited quite handsomely from those slaves and petitioned the Virginia legislature twice to keep them longer than he was legally supposed to keep them. So this notion that he was this someone who really hated slavery, because he has one quote where he says something about, you know, to the effect that if he could, that slavery is evil, but it's a lesser evil. But this notion that he hated slavery or that he was for any kind of Black equality, it's just not true.
The biggest gathering, of course, is during the first 3 days of July every year, the anniversary of the actual Battle of Gettysburg. And often, these conversations go nowhere.
Usually the reaction is denial or saying that's not true.
But sometimes they do.
There are people who will, they've emailed me afterwards or... you know, we have reasonable conversations. I don't have any illusions that I'm making a huge, you know, difference in changing people's minds about it. But I think it's important to speak the truth, whether folks are willing to wrestle with it or not.
Hancock has been confronting Confederate reenactors for the last 5 years, and the interactions have never been terrible. But last July, a rumor started that Antifa was going to come.
2020, an Antifa rumor that they were going to come and tear down or desecrate monuments and burn the suburbs of Gettysburg. And so there are all this chatter about armed militia groups coming again to Gettysburg. And despite the fact that the Gettysburg police and others were saying, this isn't an Antifa rumor that we know of, please don't come.
Fearing the crowd would be big, Hancock didn't try to talk to people this time. Instead, he created signs emblazoned with important dates in history pertaining to slavery and segregation. Then he added a phrase that read, "Murder, 2015. That was when a 21-year-old white man named Dylan Roof shot and killed 9 African-American parishioners at a Bible study at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Hancock showed up with the sign and 5 friends. They stood by the monuments of 3 southern states, North Carolina, Mississippi, and Virginia. Once they got to the Virginia monument, things went downhill pretty quickly.
They yelled at us, my friend Clotaire and I, who's black and much, much darker skin than I am. They were yelling things at us like, you're just here to get your welfare check. Go home and get your welfare check. Go back to Africa. Some of my white friends heard people using the N-word. I did not hear that, but I don't have any reason to doubt them.
When Scott and his friends got in their cars, the reenactors hopped in their cars and followed them.
We went back to our cars. They took pictures of our license plates. We had 3 cars. They followed us for about 2.5 miles till I drove to where the police headquarters were set up.
The group eventually left them alone. The experience has shaken Hancock, but not enough for him to stop engaging with reenactors and trying to balance the narrative.
As long as we have these kind of celebrations of the Confederacy that are based on a gross distortion of reality, then somebody needs to be addressing that.
The period after the Civil War is known as Reconstruction, an acknowledgement that America had been broken apart. It's also Hancock's area of focus, and one in which he says, even though black Americans had won full rights of citizenship, exercising those rights could be a death sentence.
You have a period of about a year or so where you see that vulnerability exposed, and that's when you get the KKK and white patrols, lynchings begin, a host of other ways in which African Americans are terrorized and their rights are denied, their voting rights are suppressed.
Then for a few years in the late 1860s, the federal government stepped in to try to ensure voting rights for blacks.
After the Civil War, so you have that brief window where, yeah, you got a lot of black voters, and that's why you have black men in Congress. And I keep saying we have a lot of black voters. We've got to keep in mind we're talking about black men only. But yeah, they're an actual political force.
William Sturkey says the political force didn't last. Sturkey is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, who specializes in post-Civil War African-American history.
Different paramilitary white groups formed in order to, you know, attack African-Americans who were trying to exercise their rights.
Southern white supremacists dismantled Reconstruction by threatening and terrorizing recently emancipated African-Americans.
We saw several different breakouts of political violence in places where African-Americans had political power, right? This happened in Colfax, Louisiana. It happened in Meridian, Mississippi. And then ultimately in 1875, we saw widespread violence that happened during the Mississippi election of 1875, when the biggest newspaper in the state openly called for white citizens to get out and intimidate black voters and to even kill them if necessary. And so across the South, we saw this happen in 1875 and 1876. And then ultimately, it was those contested elections that gave white supremacist Southerners the leverage they needed to broker a deal to end Reconstruction, to get the troops out of the South, and then to sort of leave them on their own accord to deal with African Americans as they chose.
The black vote became the primary target.
Black people do not get to have a say in our democracy because it's a white man's society.
After Reconstruction came nearly 90 years of Jim Crow, the legalized system of racial segregation. Jim Crow prevented black citizens from attaining things like decent jobs and housing, a good education, while denying them the right to vote.
I don't think that the whites at that time felt that blacks were equal or should have the privilege to vote.
Wilson Good made history by becoming the first black mayor of Philadelphia in 1983. But growing up in the Jim Crow South during the 40s and 50s, Good, now 82, remembers the oppressive racism his family endured and the unequal rules they had to abide by.
If you walk down the street in a town near us and someone white approached you, you had to get off the street and walk in the gutter. If you went into a store to buy food, if you were in line and someone white walked behind you, you had to get out of line and walk behind the white person.
In the mid-20th century, his parents were subjected to absurd conditions when they tried to vote.
They asked us to recite the preamble to the Constitution, and then they asked us to name all of the presidents up until Franklin Roosevelt. And then the next time they went, they had to pay a poll tax, which at that time was $10. And $10 was a lot of money back then.
It was only when Good's family migrated north to Philadelphia that his parents were able to vote. By then, they were in their early 50s.
My parents voted for the first time in November of 1954, and it brought tears to both of their eyes. And so my parents said, you always have to vote because when you vote, you count. And when you don't vote, you don't count.
The civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s pressured Congress to pass the Voting Rights Act in 1965. It was intended to protect the right to vote for Black Americans like Good's parents. Brittany Smalls works to protect it. Smalls is the Pennsylvania State Coordinator of the Black Voters Matter Fund, and she says her family still suffers from the lingering effects of living under Jim Crow for generations.
My great-great-grandfather was lynched in Charleston, South Carolina, on his way home from work, and it was like supposed to be like a mistaken identity.
That lynching changed the trajectory of Smalls' family. The murder of the family patriarch forced her great-great-grandmother to take over the household, and women have been leading ever since.
I grew up in a single-parent household, my mother, and my mother grew up in a single-parent household. My grandmother grew up in a single-parent household. My great-grandmother grew up in a single-parent household. I have to continue fighting because I'm fighting deeply for my family.
Black Voters Matter Fund was among many that were instrumental in getting out the black vote throughout Pennsylvania, in the Pittsburgh and Philadelphia suburbs, and in rural counties like Beaver, Dolphin, and Erie, and also in Philadelphia's predominantly black neighborhoods, which gave President Joe Biden overwhelming support.
Starting late 2019 into January of 2020, we looked at the data on Pennsylvania, and we wanted to look at where our people were. Philadelphia is about 44% Black, so that was one of our target locations. And instead of us creating a plan, we talked to each individual group and asked them, what can we do to support you all in this upcoming election cycle?
In the Olney neighborhood of North Philadelphia, the organization hosted a socially distant concert featuring the rapper Freeway. 600 people turned out.
So a lot of people came for the concert, but they received education, and it was even more powerful. And these young people were so impacted by hearing from their peers and people who they admire about the importance of voting that they was like, you know, so geek, like, where do I go? How do I sign up for early voting? I never even knew this existed.
Small says her work is ongoing. Voters of color are still being disenfranchised, she says, at the polls and through legislative policy. She points to House Bill 38 as an example of judicial gerrymandering. The bill would make it so appellate judges would be elected by district and not statewide. Smalls argues since judges make decisions that affect all Pennsylvanians should be able to vote for them.
If that's not clear disenfranchisement to our people who don't have access, because we already are not seeing the leaders that we want to see represent us, because it takes a lot of money to run campaigns, and our people just don't have it.
For Joe Sertain, voter suppression of people of color has been an ongoing battle. Sertain, Philadelphia's managing director under former Mayor Ed Rendell, was part of an organization that fought against Pennsylvania's voter ID law in 2012, saying it disproportionately disenfranchised a big chunk of the population.
In 2012, the whole concept of voter ID, the way it was legislated, was discriminatory. So they tried to put into place restrictions limited to identification as long as you had certain types of written identification issued by the state. It was difficult, first of all, for Black folks and folks in cities and older people and disabled people to even acquire the kind of identification that the state was trying to mandate.
Sertain says you don't need to look any further than the recent election to understand that systemic attempts to disenfranchise voters still exist.
The legislature in Pennsylvania tried to invalidate votes in the last election in 2020. So, no, it hasn't changed. This whole thing is based upon white supremacy. It never changes. It is constant. And anybody who thinks different just needs to pay attention to history.
Ever since his days growing up in Philly in the 50s, transfixed by the Westerns he watched on TV, Sertain has paid attention to history.
First of all, I was always a cowboy. Always, always, always. It was so bad that I used to go to Mass on Sunday morning and pray that there was a six gun and a hat on the chair by the kitchen door when I got home.
He knew he came from a long line of men who served in the military, but it wasn't until he did some digging on his own that he found their involvement stretched back to the Civil War and beyond. He found out that family members had fought in the colored regiments in the Civil War, and also there were cowboys in his family, Buffalo soldiers who helped protect settlers migrating west.
I had never known of Black cavalry before. Every cavalryman I ever saw was John Wayne.
Goldsby was a servant to a Confederate officer before switching to the Union side during the Battle of Gettysburg. Sertain later rode with the Buffalo soldiers as a sergeant major. Participating in reenactments was an expensive hobby.
You had to learn all that there was about that time period, acquire the correct uniforms and the accoutrements for your rank and the period of time that you're portraying. And you had to get all the horse furniture, because I was a cavalryman. You had to get all the horse furniture, saddles, bridles, rifles, and everything that goes along with that.
For almost 30 years, starting in the 1980s, Sertain participated in reenactments around the country and gave historical presentations to school children about the Buffalo soldiers and colored regiments that fought in the Civil War. He spent a lifetime in public service and devoted a lot of his life to raising awareness about the nation's military history. But he wouldn't call himself a patriot.
As a Black American, I am what I consider myself to be, and that is a citizen, with all the rights and privileges under the Constitution of the United States.
Though he loves his country and believes in its values, Sertain says the word patriot has been hijacked in such a way that Black citizens don't believe it applies to them anymore.
The word patriot has been co-opted by white supremacists and white folks in general to mean only they can love their country. And a citizen is someone who loves their country and participates in the affairs of the country. So I am a citizen.
Throughout history, Black citizens have pledged their allegiance to America, even when America turned its back on them, says Scott Hancock, the Gettysburg College historian.
We are not the ones who hate the country and are trying to teach people to hate the country. We're the ones who love the country. You say, look, this is what this country could be. We haven't been this in this ways. We can do better.
But, Hancock says, some people don't want to accept any viewpoint that opposes their own. That was one of the reasons why white nationalists stormed the Capitol on January 6, he says, to overturn an election which they believed without evidence was stolen.
The nationalists are the ones who want to shut that down, like the people on July 4th in 2020. They didn't want to hear that. They want to shut down any speech that they perceive as a threat. And I would argue that is absolutely not patriotic.
Hancock says from time to time, he finds common ground with the people he talks to. And that's where hope lies. As long as people on both sides can express their views while recognizing some truths about themselves, progress is something we can continue to make together. Real Black History was produced by Shai Binyakov and Jeanette Woods. We had editing help from Sabrina Boyd-Circa and Katie Culinary. Sandra Clark is Vice President for News and Civic Dialogue. I'm Annette John Hall. Thanks for listening.